Welcome to Rounds with the Investigators. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. On this CME program, medical oncologist in community-based practice, Drs. Maggie Deutsch, Linda Ferris, Steve Grabelski, Estella Marie Rodriguez, Eric Rupard, and Luis Reyes present patients from their practices with lung cancer to distinguished faculty investigators, Drs. Corey Langer, Tom Lynch, Jyothi Patel, and Greg Riley. To begin, Dr. Deutsch presented a woman from her practice.
This is a 67-year-old woman who was found incidentally on a chest x-ray to have an ill-defined mass in the right upper lobe. And she underwent repeat imaging at 3 months and showed enlargement in the area of the abnormality. A PET scan was performed, which showed slight FDG activity in the right upper lobe, but no mediastinal lymphadenopathy. And she underwent a bronchoscopy, and washings were consistent with adenocarcinoma with the possibility of bronchoalveolar carcinoma. She was taken to the OR and had a right upper lobe resection. She had a 3 by 1.5 by 1 centimeter adenocarcinoma with some areas of poorly differentiated disease and what was reported as peripheral changes of bronchoalveolar carcinoma. I don't know what that means. She had lymphovascular invasion. 3 of 6 peribronchial lymph nodes were positive for metastatic disease, and no mediastinal lymph nodes were sampled. I know.
What type of surgeon did this? Was it a thoracic surgeon, thoracic oncologist?
He is a CT surgeon who I would say does far more hearts than lungs, so not dedicated to lung surgery.
How did the patient do post-op?
Postoperatively, it was difficult for her. She had a persistent air leak that required a chest tube for about 10 days, but eventually was able to close her air leak and get the chest tube taken out. She is a reformed smoker, smoked in college, but hasn't smoked since then. She's also a former nurse, now retired.
And what would you say her sort of pack year history was when you say she smoked in college?
Pretty small, maybe smoked 2 or 3 years in college and then quit. So really quite minimal smoking history.
So, Greg, would you want to see her tumor tested for EGFR or ALK or ROS1?
You know, we as a group have made the decision that we think all patients who have lung cancer should have molecular testing done. One can argue about the relevance of this mutation testing molecular analysis in patients with early stage disease. Unfortunately, the reality is that many of these patients have recurrent disease. With a patient with stage 2 lung cancer like this, it's a 50% chance of recurrent disease. And when you have the tissue and you have the time, it's a reasonable thing to try to get that analysis done now.
How often, Corey, do you see patients having these kind of post-op problems, you know, persistent air leak with a chest tube for 10 days?
Not uncommon, 10, 20%. This is the cost of doing business in the thorax. Unfortunately, probably 40 to 50% of patients that I've seen, not specifically within Penn, but within the Delaware Valley, have had what I consider to be a non-cancer operation. This person did not have mediastinal node sampling. As a community, at least as oncologists, we tolerate a level, and I'll call it frankly malpractice, that would never be tolerated in breast cancer. This person has not been completely staged. We do not know the status of the mediastinum. Presumably the PET and the CT were negative in the mediastinum pre-op,
sure.
But I haven't heard any mention of either EBIS or mediastinoscopy. I gather the tumor was probably too small to warrant an automatic mediastinoscopy pre-op. Certainly larger tumors might.
I think the fact that her PET scan was negative.
Negative. So I think,
although having said that, her primary wasn't particularly positive on PET either. It was only slightly
hypermetabolic. So it was only vaguely
positive.
So a cardiothoracic surgeon, someone who spends more time dealing with the hearts, did a cancer operation, and these folks need to be retrained. This patient did not have, as far as technically you could call it an R0 resection, but they didn't have all the node sampled. So it's not a full cancer operation. And we struggle with this. Should we sample the mediastinum somehow? Should we do an EBIS? Should we do a mediastinoscopy? How will it alter what we do if there's extant, actual, viable tumor? It's an R1, R2 resection. And you would approach that patient completely differently. If you knew that there was active disease in the mediastinum, you would approach this patient potentially as a 3A and give them concurrent chemoradiation. So I think there's a lot of education that needs to go on out there, particularly in the surgical community and the thoracic surgical oncology community.
Now, when did you see her for the first time?
I saw her post-op.
And what was her general condition and attitude?
Her general condition is really pretty good. She does not have any other chronic medical illnesses except for very mild hypertension. She's very active. Actually, the first thing she said to me is, I want to go take care of my horse and ride it. And that's what she does. She has a horse that she takes care of, and that's her hobby in her life. And that was what she wanted to do as soon as she got over her air leak.
So, Greg, what would you be thinking about in this lady at this point?
So the patient has at least a stage 2 lung cancer based upon the nodes that we have assessed. And it's quite possible, given that she has 3 out of 6 positive nodes, quite possible that there's mediastinal lymph node involvement. Both of those things, with what we have in the pathology lab already, the patient should get adjuvant chemotherapy or should be offered adjuvant chemotherapy with the idea of reducing the risk of recurrence in a statistically and clinically significant amount.
So what would be the options, and what do you think you most likely would offer her specifically?
So the use of adjuvant chemotherapy in lung cancer is really, I think, all over the map in terms of the types of chemotherapy people use, with one hopeful point of agreement. Most people, I think, agree that cisplatin should be a part of the adjuvant chemotherapy regimen if it can be. All the data that we have showing improved overall survival for adjuvant chemotherapy is with cisplatin and a vinca alkaloid or cisplatin and etoposide. Many people have made an extrapolation from treatment of stage 4 lung cancer that cisplatin pemetrexed or cisplatin docetaxel or cisplatin gemcitabine would be appropriate. And I think the evidence of that is that in the large ECOG trial randomizing patients to chemotherapy with or without bevacizumab, all those chemotherapies are standard options in that clinical trial. You know, given that we are in a curative setting, I do kind of lean back on data that shows actual improvement in overall survival, and my tendency is to use cisplatin vinorelbine as my primary chemotherapy of choice. If there are things that push me away from it, then I certainly am flexible, but if I'm given my choice, I will pick cisplatin vinorelbine.
And Corey, you know, you're working with us on a program where you've gone out and given talks. We have other investigators where we just presented ahead of time basic clinical situations to the faculty and said, well, what do you think you would likely do? And one of them was this kind of a situation. What do you think you would likely do with this lady? And what's your perception about what most investigators might do with this patient?
So I agree with Greg that the evidence-based data are cisplatin vinorelbine, but I think there's been a major shift, certainly by extrapolation from stage 4 disease to a much more user-friendly cis-PEM regimen. This woman's a horseback rider, probably going to be concerned about neuropathy. You've got 2 potential hits on neuropathy with cisvinorelbine. So here I think the patient's lifestyle and certainly quality of life issues in my mind would potentially dictate cis-PEM. Intriguingly, there was a study presented last year at ASCO called the TREAT trial that directly compared cis-PEM to cisvinorelbine and, no surprise, showed cis-PEM was far better tolerated. Much higher percentage of patients were able to complete treatment. There were fewer dropouts. Of course, it was very early data. We have no long-term follow-up in terms of relative efficacy, but I think we'd all be shocked if there were major differences in terms of outcome. Perhaps the newer combinations, because they do seem to be better in advanced disease, will translate into an improvement in earlier stage disease. We're certainly hoping for that, but that's the only trial I'm aware of that is comparing third generation, or you could almost call it fourth generation, to third generation chemo. I agree with Greg in that I would use cisplatin. Here are the data, particularly for node-positive disease, it's strictly with cisplatin. And in the curative setting, I will use cisplatin, even though I'm pretty doctrinaire about using carbo in stage 4 in the incurable setting. So it's intriguing when we go out in the hustings and see how investigators or community oncologists respond to the same question. A fair number will use carboplatin-based combo.
I was telling Maggie that in recent surveys we've done, there's a lot, maybe most investigators using cis-PEM for adjuvant non-squamous outside a trial, particularly after the so-called TREAT trial comparing cis-PEM to cisvinorelbine was reported at ASCO 2011.
I think a lot of community-based oncologists come to this conclusion on their own. Very few are even aware of the TREAT trial. Unless they're card-carrying members of Thoracic Cognoscente, they haven't seen the presentation, and it's not really been well publicized. So because it's adenocarcinoma, and because PEM has an indication in advanced disease, it seems to be tracking over into earlier stage, certainly into the adjuvant setting. I think the take-up of PEM in locally advanced is far slower.
Steve?
I would concur from the community standpoint. In this particular instance, you're talking about using pemetrexed cisplatin. Again, there is no randomized adjuvant trial. As Greg said, you know, the data is with vinorelbine cisplatin. And, you know, it's reassuring when you hear that the thought leaders and the people that are doing thoracic oncology day in and day out are substituting pemetrexed cisplatin in the adjuvant setting. It reaffirms what you're doing in the community.
Can I just make another comment? ECOG, the ongoing adjuvant trials, have accommodated the observation that many of us are, shall we say, less than thrilled with cisplatin vinorelbine, primarily because of toxicity issues, and have given us the leeway, the option of choosing various partner agents with cisplatin. So cis-pemetrexed, cis-gemcitabine, cis-docetaxel, cis-vinorelbine, all the combinations that Greg enumerated are allowable as platform regimens in the ongoing trial. And intriguingly, with the approval of pemetrexed really just a year and a half ago, the uptake on the adjuvant trial with the PEM-CIS combination has gone up. Knowing this, I think, again, also gives validation to what clinicians and community are doing.
And actually, Steve's going to present a patient from that trial in a minute, but maybe you can just follow up with what happened to this lady.
So I saw her, and I actually treated her with cisplatin vinorelbine, because U.S. Oncology has a strong pathway program, and I follow the pathways. So, and they are very rigorously vetted every year. And
I just thought it was interesting that the pathway didn't include what would be the most common choice of investigators.
It's because it hasn't been vetted yet.
You have to get an exception, right?
Yes, but since I chair the P&T committee, that exception is pretty easy. But they have not yet put cis-pemetrexed on for adjuvant therapy. I suspect it'll be reviewed. You know, they rigorously review their pathways every 6 months and add, but they add according to and based on data. And so they're very rigorous about their pathways. So
I would imagine some component of their analysis of this is making sure that they get reimbursed for an expensive drug like pemetrexed. Is that a problem for people?
I don't think the reimbursement would have been the issue.
Okay. What about the cost? You know, when these pathways, are there specific implications in terms? I think you mentioned there's now, you know, agreements out there with
for
insurers.
Instance, our group has a contract in place with Blue Cross Blue Shield that dictates we will follow our pathways and have at least 60% of people on pathway.
So what happened with this lady?
So she has been on cisplatin vinorelbine and has not tolerated the treatment well at all. She has had a lot of nausea, fatigue, feels crummy most of the time, but she's actually very bright and has been out on the web reading and says, I'm finishing this cisplatin no matter what, because she's convinced the cisplatin is the best agent for her. I've not offered her to combine it with pemetrexed, although I did tell her I was going to talk about her case today.
So, how many cycles?
She has one more cycle to go.
What schedule are you using? Because there's different schedules.
I use day one, day eight cis with day 1, 8, 15 vinorelbine, but she's never gotten a day 15 dose because she's been too cytopenic to get it.
I think it's interesting. The BR10 was done with a day 1, day 8 weekly without interruption in the vinorelbine. And needless to say, they had a fair number of dose reductions and omissions in that trial. But even with that impediment, with a high percentage of patients not able to complete all four, they still observed the survival advantage in strictly in the stage 2, what we hope this patient has. Mm-hmm. We don't really know. So even though it's frustrating when you can't get the drugs in, you don't know necessarily that that will automatically translate into an inferior outcome. Having said that, Francis Shepard and actually the intergroup trial employ a different regimen. They give platinum once every 3 weeks, 75 per meter squared. So at least that spares the day 8 therapy, and the vinorelbine is day 1 and 8 every 3 weeks. So the day 15 dose, which is tough to give, is automatically omitted.
Right, and she has never to date gotten a day 15 dose, and the cis has been split. Actually, the last time when she came in for day 8, I gave her carbo and AUC of 2 mm-hmm. because she just felt so awful. And then she came back last week and said, I'm finishing those last two doses of cisplatin, no matter what.
So there's another aspect to this case that's pretty interesting, which is she has an EGFR mutation, correct?
She does. I tested her. She was positive in exon 18.
So exon 18, do you remember, was that a G719?
Codon 18? 719.
Okay. Okay, so that's one of the less common EGFR mutations. It's likely to be one of the ones that's sensitive, and most times the data has been presented, those are sensitizing mutations. But it's tough to remember which one of these mutations are sensitizing, which ones, you know, when I say sensitizing, I mean the patients are going to respond to erlotinib in the advanced setting.
Actually, when I got the result, it told me which exons were the right ones.
But in terms of whether it corresponds to TKI sensitivity, I think Tom was referring to William Powell's website or something. Is there any other place that you can go?
Yeah, so William Powell has a website. It's called My Cancer Genome, and it's run in collaboration with Vanderbilt, and a fair number of academic investigators edit various pages on it, and it helps pick out which of these mutations are sensitizing mutations, which ones we don't know about. He has it for non-small cell lung cancer and EGFR mutations, but it also has data for BRAF mutant melanoma, colorectal cancer, among others.
So this lady, she's a retired nurse, and she's obviously out there trying to figure stuff out. But imagine the question of whether or not she should get a TKI has come up.
It has come up. I told her there's no data in the adjuvant setting for erlotinib, and yesterday she said to me, you know, I feel so awful, and she said if I took that stuff, it would just, you know, make me feel worse. You know, she's kind of decided in her head that if she can just get through these four cycles, she wants to stop. But she's been out looking at it on the internet and was not really too fond of the side effects.
So great.
Although they couldn't be worse than what she's getting now.
If she were to come to you and say, what do you think about the idea of erlotinib, what would you say?
So we would sit down and we'd talk about it. And the clear admission that I have to start with is that there's no prospective randomized data to support the use of erlotinib in the adjuvant setting. It's been studied adjuvant in a variety of ways and never shown benefit, and even shown a little bit of harm with gefitinib in the adjuvant setting. That said, we have a fair amount of retrospective data from our own institution, which has been presented and probably published shortly, that suggests that there's a benefit. It's hard for me to imagine that there's a detriment in overall survival for patients with EGFR mutations to get an EGFR TKI in this setting. And so I offer it. And one thing that's really hard about taking it is this time frame that is essentially arbitrary. Most people talk about doing it for 2 years. And we don't know it has to be 2 years. We don't know if it has to be 1 year. We don't know if it has to be 6 months. We don't know if it has to be like a breast cancer patient and they have to receive it for 10 years. So that makes it very difficult to make the plans. But in general, I offer adjuvant erlotinib, even recommend it, and recommend it for 2 years.
And if she were to say, well, I've been reading about this, and could I maybe take a lower dose, like 100 milligrams?
There's a fair amount of disagreement within my own group about the approach to patients in terms of dose in the adjuvant setting. My general approach is to start with 150, see what the side effects are, and dose reduce with the idea that we're going to do this for the long term, and so we have to get it to a tolerable dose. My colleague, Mark Chris, likes to start lower, and if the patients don't have any side effects, he may work his way up, but in general won't go above 100.
So this is another example where, we can give you quantitative data, and I can tell you if I present this question to 25 thoracic oncologists, EGFR mutation in the adjuvant setting, probably almost all of them except Greg or the people at Memorial will say no, and I'm going to guess Corey would say no.
Outside of a clinical trial, I simply won't do it.
So one thing that's really troubling to me is that the answer to this question, adjuvant questions take a long time to get answers to, and so things have to be in place. The unfortunate truth is that we're not going to have an answer to this question anytime soon. The one adjuvant trial that has been organized in this setting was a trial called Radiant that was led by the manufacturer of erlotinib. And they didn't use EGFR mutation as the entry criteria. They used EGFR immunohistochemistry, essentially taking most comers is probably the best way to say it. And it was a relatively small randomized trial. And so they've presented the data which tells us how many patients with EGFR mutations were in this trial. And based upon the expected effect size, there's essentially no chance that that trial will be positive for EGFR mutant lung cancer in the adjuvant setting. So we don't have a decently powered randomized trial exploring this question right now. And I think there's an effort through the intergroup to try to do this in a prospective way, but that's not yet begun even.
Certainly not in North America. There is a very interesting trial spearheaded by Jean-Charles Soria in France called the TASTE trial, strictly in non-squames. The control arm is PEM-CIS, all comers. And then the investigational arm assigns treatment based both on EGFR mutation and on ERCC1 status. So if they're EGFR mutant, they'll go to, is it trafitinib or erlotinib?
I believe it's
erlotinib, EGFR TKI du jour. And if they're not and they have a low ERCC1, they'll get PEMCIS. And if they're wild type for EGFR and they have high ERCC1, they're actually observed. And this, again, is extrapolated from the YALT data where ERCC1 seemed to be a discriminant for outcome. So that at least is accruing. I agree with Greg, it's going to be years before we see the results, but it'll be a true test, I think, of the potential role. The problem is it's not being done in the context of patients who are already getting chemo, which would arguably be the standard in that population. It's not chemo plus or minus erlotinib. It's chemo versus erlotinib.
Right. And I that's the thing that I find difficult to swallow. We've seen in the diseases that we've cured, testicular cancer, lymphoma, that we try to maybe back off treatment strategies a little bit to make them a little less toxic to see if we can get the same cure rates with less toxicity. And in general, those approaches haven't been particularly successful. Oftentimes, they lead to reduced cure rates, cisplatin versus carboplatin in germ cell tumors, for instance. And I would say that, you know, the risks of dying from lung cancer in a patient who's had an operation for lung cancer is very high. And to not give them something that's proven to have benefit is a strategy that I wouldn't favor. And so I think chemotherapy has a proven role, and patients should get chemotherapy. And if we can add something more onto it to make it better, I'm all in favor of studying that.
I got to say, personally, it's kind of discouraging, kind of frustrating to think that there's not a ongoing prospective trial of people with EGFR mutations about whether to take an EGFR TKI. I mean, it's unbelievable to me that there's no trial out there in the U.S. doing that.
I suspect there will be at some point. It may not be a cooperative group. It may be an industry-sponsored trial.
Ramaswamy Govindan is organizing this through the cooperative groups, and I think it should move forward.
Just out of curiosity, Greg, if this lady, she gets through her chemo and she goes back to her horses and she's feeling good, and it's 6 months later, and she goes, you know, I'm really feeling good now. I've been reading about EGFR mutations. What about if I take it now?
I think I was on thin ice before recommending it, and the ice is breaking up as I get further away from the time of the operation.
Life preserver.
So I want to go on.
I'm not going in after you.
I want to go to Steve's patient in a second. But one final question to Corey. If this lady had her mediastinum looked at it and were positive, how would you approach it?
Very controversial area. The port analysis, of course, suggested that you shouldn't give radiation, period, even if they had N2 involvement, although in that group there at least wasn't a survival decrement, but there was no survival improvement. And yet there are two recent analyses, one post hoc, not planned, in the ANITA trial where N2 patients who did get radiation plus chemo did better than those who got chemo alone. Again, the numbers are relatively small, but it was a striking additional survival advantage. And then Brian Lally's retrospective analysis of the SEER data, which is a huge database and, of course, all sorts of potential bias. But in the N2 resected group, those who got radiation, regardless of whether they got anything else, did better than those who had surgery alone. Off study, if the nodes are involved, we have tended to give radiation at the very minimum. With modern radiation, we can certainly reduce the risk of local recurrence. We have some hint, perhaps, that there might be a survival advantage. And unlike the trials that were used in the port analysis, modern radiation is far safer. And I think a lot of the survival decrement that came from the port analysis was due to really antediluvian radiation, radiation that's just not used these days. Some of those trials were from the 60s, 70s, early 80s, and it's just no longer relevant to current practice. Europe is prospectively looking at this issue. The lung DART trial is an ongoing phase 3 comparing post-op mediastinal radiation, so port versus standard observation in patients who largely have been treated with chemo adjuvantly. So eventually, hopefully, we'll get a real answer in modern times. But again, I think you can defend either approach.
Would you add any chemotherapy to the radiation?
No. Outside of a clinical trial. I think the one area where we might contemplate that is if they had very bulky mediastinal disease, even if it had been resected and there was invasion through the nodal capsule. But again, this is all by extrapolation from the locally advanced unresected population.
So I want to just bring in briefly Steve's case, and rather kind of going through it in detail the way we did this one, maybe you can just sort of briefly talk about what happened to the patient. This patient was on the ECOG 1505 trial, and I kind of wanted to get your take on that question and other adjuvant trials, and also in terms of bevacizumab, because I think what happened to this patient was kind of interesting.
54-year-old male smoker who on a chest x-ray and PET-CT scan had a left lower lobe nodule, had a left hilar lymph node that was hypermetabolic on PET-CT scan, transthoracic final aspiration revealed poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma, preoperative bronchoscopy and mediastinoscopy were negative, and he underwent a left lower lobectomy, thoracoscopic assisted. Final pathology revealed a 2.7 centimeter moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma with 2 of 12 positive hilar nodes and 2 positive level 10 lymph nodes. Patient was subsequently enrolled on ECOG 1505 and was randomized to receive bevacizumab with dealer's choice chemotherapy, as we had already discussed. We chose to treat him with pemetrexed and cisplatin for 4 cycles, and he then was randomized to the maintenance bevacizumab arm.
Can you just bring us up to date?
So he was on maintenance bevacizumab for approximately 3 months and had some mild hypertension, did need to go on an antihypertensive medication, and had some mild epistaxis that did not require any intervention. Patient subsequently elected to stop the bevacizumab at the time that the data was coming out in the lay press about the lack of benefit of bevacizumab in breast cancer and about the increased risk of cardiovascular events. And because of those, despite multiple discussions, the patient elected to discontinue the maintenance bevacizumab after only completing 3 months of the planned 12 months.
So, you know, there are times when it's useful to have visuals. I wish people driving along the roads of America could have seen Corey's face as you were describing that. Corey, what were your thoughts?
I have the lay press maybe deliberately influences medical decisions by the lay community. I mean, I remember when those studies were coming out, I had to do a lot of damage control. As somebody who gives a lot of bevacizumab, certainly in advanced disease, the same issues were coming up. There seemed to be this automatic extrapolation from other diseases into lung. And I think if I've learned anything in the last 25 years of practice, every disease is different. Every indication for the same drug in different diseases is different. You can't do that extrapolation. The other issue I think was perhaps exaggerated by that article was the cardiovascular risk. It wasn't put in proper perspective. There was a retrospective study of bevacizumab in the elderly. Purely retrospective, I think based on Medicare data. SEER data, Medicare data, that suggests there's no survival advantage in the elderly. This is not prospective randomized data. This is retrospective. So I think we have to be very careful when we start assigning level one evidence to those sorts of evaluations. And I feel badly. I mean, yes, there's a chance. This patient, fortunately, wasn't having any untoward toxicity. From your description, it sounds like he could have tolerated continued treatment. And here we have the effects of the lay press inadvertently influencing decision making.
Greg, what about this issue of this adjuvant trial, the Bev's being given for a year? We have seen data in colon cancer, you know, that was negative, although there was maybe a question about duration. There's a colon cancer advanced disease trial looking at continuation of Bev on progression that has a positive survival advantage for continuing bevacizumab. What about this issue of the adjuvant trial in lung cancer?
So I think this issue of maintenance bevacizumab, adjuvant bevacizumab, you know, where we don't really know in the advanced disease setting, we have no idea what the role of maintenance bevacizumab is. We know that the trial that led us to use bevacizumab, the ECOG 4599, used maintenance bevacizumab, so we do it. But to understand the single agent activity of bevacizumab in lung cancer, we don't know it. It's probably next to none. And to think that it has some magical properties to treat these patients, it's unclear. But clearly this patient was in a clinical trial, which is a scientific experiment to find out what the result of doing a certain pathway is. And we want patients to go with us on that journey to try to understand what the importance of doing this is. And, you know, the patient learned about the side effects of bevacizumab from the informed consent, the conversation with you at the beginning. And it's too bad that the lay press, which you know, means well, I have to hope. I hope they mean well. They take a large amount of data and they try to distill it down. And unfortunately, sometimes the wrong message comes through. And just like Corey, you know, I think those data that came out, I guess was last summer now, really lumped together many diseases into one analysis and showed that some patients didn't do well. It really forgets the fact that in stage four lung cancer, this trial was done, and you know, when they looked at the end of it, more people were alive if they got bevacizumab. You know, all these potential risks were incorporated into that endpoint. More people are alive, and that to me speaks a lot. So for this patient, I sure wish they could have gotten through, but you know, I've been in your shoes, and once the patient has made up their mind, there's often nothing you can do to convince them otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, we had half a dozen discussions, you know.
I'm sure.
And he was just set. He said, you know, I feel like I've already gotten, I had it with my chemotherapy, and I had it, you know, for 3 months, and I've, you know.
And there'll be plenty of other patients on that trial that did not complete the full year.
Right.
Either because of toxicity or because of, this would be considered patient discontinuation on their own. And certainly the reasons for treatment discontinuation will be iterated at the end of the trial. But I agree with Greg. I think in a perfect world, were I to go back and reconstruct this trial, we would have a control arm, a second arm with bevacizumab just during the chemotherapy, which frankly would, it's main reason many patients I've offered this trial won't go on it. They just can't brook the notion of getting a full year of treatment. It's inconvenient. They have to come back every 3 weeks.
They're, but they do it in breast cancer.
Yeah, but the lung cancer community, I think, is a little bit different. The, well, maybe not. And, you know, like your patient, they want to go back to their horseback riding, or in case of many of my patients, they want to be snowbirds and come down here to Florida. And then the third arm would be the continuation for however long we think it should be. A year was purely arbitrary. And the last thing I want to mention, there is an ongoing trial analogous to the colorectal trials called AVAOL, which is looking at bevacizumab beyond progression in advanced non-small cell. So these are folks who have the indications for bevacizumab, who have gotten combination bevacizumab with chemo and have actually gone on to maintenance, have had at least two cycles of single agent maintenance bevacizumab, and then at the time of progression are randomized to standard of care, which is standard second line, either pemetrexed, docetaxel, or erlotinib, or standard of care plus continuation of Bev in that setting. So this is an international effort. You know, the angiogenic impulse in cancer does not go away. So my continuation of bevacizumab is the prototype confer an additional survival advantage beyond progression? It's a reasonable question to ask.
Are there any situations right now where you would do that outside a protocol setting? This comes up all the time in colorectal cancer, and where we hear about it is a patient who's having a great response to chemo bevacizumab and then sort of slowly progresses.
I certainly, whenever a patient of mine is on maintenance bevacizumab and they progress, I don't continue bevacizumab. I think that in the colorectal world, there's been a lot of registry data and other sorts of data that build a case that it makes sense. I haven't seen that sort of data in lung cancer, and I haven't gone out on that one.
Luis?
Maybe we will agree. You know, I think bevacizumab is a great drug, but not for everybody. So how about the marker for bevacizumab?
A biomarker for bevacizumab. It's a dream, isn't it? I think that's where it stands at the moment. Certainly lots of folks working hard on biomarkers for all sorts of the anti-angiogenesis drugs, including bevacizumab, but it doesn't seem like anything's jumping out at us yet.
Devoutly to be hoped for and completely unfindable. It's a big concern because I think we now have a mindset, particularly with the advent of ALK inhibition and EGFR mutation, that unless we find that elusive marker, we're not going to be able to figure out which patients benefit the most. And I think that is an issue. And remember, this is a drug that works on the tumor milieu, not on the cancer cell directly, and that makes it unique.
So Eric, maybe you can briefly present your 55-year-old man.
Yeah, this was a sad case that I had really shortly after I arrived in my current location in southern Utah. It's a 53-year-old Samoan gentleman who actually was the volleyball coach at the big high school in the area and was really well known in the community. He was a non-smoker, is LDS, a Mormon. He was admitted through our emergency department in June of 2011 after presenting with a headache and shortness of breath. The CT scan showed a 2-centimeter area in the right parietal lesion of his brain, and a chest CT that was done at the time revealed innumerable small lung lesions in every lobe, with the lower lobes more involved than the upper lobes.
And so he was short of breath?
The shortness of breath really was a secondary issue. In fact, he didn't come in complaining of shortness of breath. He came in with a headache. And when he was asked on his review of systems, are you short of breath, he kind of, you know, grudgingly acknowledged, yeah, he'd been a little more short of breath lately. So surprisingly, it wasn't a big issue. This is a very fit guy prior to all this occurring. So he ended up getting a percutaneous biopsy, which showed an adenocarcinoma, and the histologic pattern was consistent with bronchoalveolar carcinoma. He had EGFR testing, which came back positive.
Before you go on, because I kind of would like to see what Greg and Corey would be thinking, anything else you want to say up until, you know, that point?
So at this point, he was walking into my clinic, talking to me, looking generally well, not having any focal neurologic deficits, but complaining of this headache.
So Greg, what would you be thinking?
Well, the first thing, when you see a scan like this gentleman who has diffuse pulmonary disease with nodules in every part of the lung that you can see. When this patient walks into your clinic, like some of us have said, you know, surprisingly, he was short of breath. But most of these never smokers can tolerate a fair amount of pulmonary parenchymal disease before they develop any pulmonary symptoms. It's really, to me, kind of shocking, having seen plenty of people with damaged lungs from cigarette smoking. These people who never smoked have a lot of reserve, and they can have quite a bit of parenchymal disease before they notice any symptoms, and this is a great example of that. One other thing I wanted to briefly mention, the description of the pathology on this case, and we've heard other cases where the pathologist calls it adenocarcinoma with BAC features or something like that. The word BAC or the phrase BAC has become nearly meaningless to some extent because it refers to so many different entities. It began as a thing back in the 60s that there was a purely non-invasive ground glass opacity in the lung, and then it was resected and it was non-invasive. That was BAC. And then we managed to torture it over the last few years so that an invasive adenocarcinoma where there's a little bit of non-invasive portion is called an adenocarcinoma with BAC. The pathology community has gotten together over the last few years to try to figure this out. And there was a recent paper published in the Journal of Thoracic Oncology, again, like Dr. Langer said, for the Cognoscenti only. But it's going to try to make its way into the literature for general pathologists and general oncologists, and basically does away with this notion of BAC, or not the notion of BAC, but the word BAC, and changes what we used to think of as pure BAC of non-invasive tumor into adenocarcinoma in situ. And then tumors like this, which is clearly an invasive adenocarcinoma that has some features of what we used to call BAC, is now called an invasive adenocarcinoma with lipidic features. And that helps to differentiate this because this patient with disease in every aspect of the lung is not what we used to think of as BAC.
I'll tell you, I've seen two patients who had CT scans that looked like this that were also described as having those lipidic features, and they both clinically behaved very similarly. So
they look much better than their scans.
Absolutely.
This also, in kind of an extreme case, but brings up the topic of first-line treatment of patient with EGFR mutations. Greg, and are there any situations where you would consider chemotherapy for any reason, maybe rapidity or, you know, better effect or anything in a situation like this? And also, would you have radiated his brain or not?
So the patient's brain metastasis, how large?
It was a couple of centimeters.
It was resected or it was just
1.8 centimeters.
Okay.
No, it was not resected.
Solitary?
It was solitary. That's correct.
You know, when you're deciding on initial therapy for a patient with lung cancer, the critical elements are deciding what you need to do first, right? You know, this is our mantra when we think about patients with lung cancer, you know, drain that pleural effusion and radiate those brain metastases. And largely those mantras are developed because our chemotherapy isn't that good. And I think this patient allows us to think a little bit differently in a setting where we have a systemic therapy which is relatively effective and relatively rapidly acting. I think that that kind of trumps all. And so for a patient, even with a 2-centimeter brain metastasis, if I know that they have an EGFR mutation in their tumor, then I will treat initially with erlotinib as my sole therapy. I will not use chemotherapy. I won't use radiation therapy. But I'm going to monitor things as I go forward, you know. And so a few weeks to a month in, I'm going to make sure that they're responding in the chest. And I'm going to make sure that their brain metastasis is responding to prevent a non-response situation turning into something worse.
Again, I think I see an interesting look on your face, Corey. Agree or disagree?
I mostly agree. I think, you know, this notion that somehow chemo is going to affect a faster response has fallen by the wayside. We have six separate trials now that clearly show an advantage for an EGFR TKI. Two of these trials include derlotinib, both in terms of response rate and progression-free survival. That elusive overall survival benefit has not yet been observed, but in the short term, this person needs to respond quickly, and I will preferentially give this individual erlotinib. Where I differ with Greg is the patient is symptomatic in the brain, is having headaches, is at risk for other complications, including seizures. So in this modern era where stereotactic radiation is available, I'll probably also have the patient undergo SRS, and I don't think that would interfere with the erlotinib at all. So rather than monitoring for response in the brain, I'd rather monitor for both response in the chest with erlotinib and then response in the brain both with erlotinib and the radiation, and reserve either surgery or whole brain radiation for additional relapse in the brain.
So maybe you can follow up with what happened.
Well, you know, the kind of the next decision point came just a couple of weeks later. Surprisingly, he really deteriorated neurologically quite rapidly, began to have an inability to swallow when he saw me in clinic just about a month later, and I ended up having to bring him into the hospital because of that. I didn't think he was able to protect his airways. So I guess that's another decision point. At this point, do you say, wait a minute, maybe the erlotinib is not having an effect yet, or would at this point would you change your course?
So this was 2 weeks after beginning erlotinib.
Yes.
He had this neurologic decline.
Correct.
Okay. And his swallowing was central disease? I mean, brain?
Or? It was felt to be. It was felt to be related to this. There wasn't any other explanation for it.
Hadn't undergone any other treatment to the brain.
Correct. Had not.
Maybe he got meningeal carcinomatosis.
Was he on steroids at that point?
He was. Yeah, he was on steroids the first day I saw him.
Maybe you can just follow up with what happened.
Yeah, so he got admitted to the hospital. He was originally on the hospital floor. Speech therapy was seeing him, and he seemed to be progressing, but then he developed this worsening hypoxia, and they thought that he might have had a pulmonary embolus, so they did another CT scan. This was read by our radiologist, and I sat down with him as kind of a coalescence of these lesions in the lungs. And a coalescence of the lesions, you know, really throughout. And he became dramatically hypoxic. There was no evidence of any other cause of his hypoxia, and I don't think you need it.
What kind of mutation did he have?
He had EGFR, just a standard. I apologize.
It was 19 or 21. It was one of the two most common kinds.
Yeah, it was. Correct. That's correct.
And
yeah.
He died?
He did. He passed away.
Any comments about the case, Greg?
So certainly we get excited about EGFR mutant lung cancer and we see these great response rates. All told, the response rates are generally in the 50 to 60% range, and that underestimates things a little bit. If you look at actual tumor shrinkage, a lot more patients have some tumor shrinkage or at least stable disease. But there are still patients who have frank tumor progression despite initiation of erlotinib, and these are incredibly frustrating situations. And it's also worse when you have a case like this where the patient is progressing in both places, you know, both the brain and systemically, and you're boxed in terms of what you can do. And this is certainly a patient who you wouldn't be able to give chemotherapy to because of their declining performance status. And so I think this is a tough situation.
I'll tell you, all of my colleagues, all three oncologists in town at our tumor board, felt like I should give him chemotherapy after he began to deteriorate clinically, you know, and kind of before he'd reached that sort of point of no return. And I stood fast with the erlotinib, and I talked to Dr. Love on the phone about it. I've questioned that decision many, many times since that, whether I should have pulled the trigger and given him some pemetrexed, you know, something along the lines. But
I have a feeling whatever spelled his progression on erlotinib would have very likely spelled progression on standard chemotherapy. And we spend so much time second-guessing ourselves because we are dealing with fatal illness that can claim lives so quickly. And, you know, here complete strangers have come to us and they've entrusted their lives in our hands and hoping that we will make the right therapeutic decision, complete strangers. So it is a huge responsibility, but on the other hand, this is cancer. It's advanced cancer. This man had fulminant disease with massive bilateral pulmonary involvement. So, you know, you've done everything you could have possibly done. When patients are falling off the cliff, as this one was, you know, trying to figure out when to intervene sooner is a tough issue. But I've gone through the same ruminations that you have, and you just can't dwell on that.
Yeah, I just have to divert out for a minute listening to what you just said. And, you know, I'm outside the situation watching all you do this. I mean, you know, I haven't taken care of a patient quite a while because we're pretty busy just doing CME. I'm just kind of curious, Eric, how being an oncologist affects you, how taking care of a patient like that affects you personally, and what you do to kind of keep your boat afloat.
So this was a gentleman, as I mentioned, who was well known in the community. By the time that, you know, a couple of weeks after he saw me, there was a Facebook page dedicated to him. People had wristbands, you know, team with his first name on it. So it definitely did affect me. It affected me a lot. I really wanted to be successful with this one. And to be honest with you, I felt like I was going to be. And I think that's what made the failure hurt the most. I had had a similar case that responded so dramatically to erlotinib that I really thought this thing would melt away. And to be perfectly honest, much to my regret, I encouraged the family to believe that that would occur as well. And when it did not occur and he just continued to clinically deteriorate, it was devastating to me. I think all of us have learned to compartmentalize to some degree, taking care of our patients and our regular lives with our families and so on. But of course, there's some carryover. And this one affected me, you know, it affected me personally. It didn't make me feel like I'm doing the wrong job or anything like that. But it certainly made me want to sort of be even more careful to cross every T and dot every I in these cases.
I want to ask Maggie to respond to this also. But again, I'm just kind of curious, Eric, what do you do? You know, and I'm really curious of people who see lung cancer, you know, what do you do to take care of yourself? And what do you see in your colleagues?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think part of what I usually do, which I failed to do in this case, is manage the expectations of the patients. You know, when they come in, express to them very clearly where their disease is going. I think of a gentleman I had when I was in the military who was a 3-star general, active duty, and he came in with his metastatic lung cancer and said, I beat the Germans, I beat the Japanese. He didn't say it in that way, by the way. He used other words, but... and he said, I'll beat this lung cancer too. And of course, I think in my mind, you know, you probably won't beat this one. But he did for a while, and I, over the course of time, was able to manage his expectations down or to lower his expectations. So for me, that's a big part of it, is early on trying to manage the expectations of the patients, and sometimes even more importantly, the family members of the patients. You know, when you walk into the room and there are 7 family members and they're kind of hovering over you and taking notes, or I've had a few tape record me, trying to manage those expectations as well. And that, I think, makes the blow a little less. But I'll be honest with you, there are times I just allow myself to be, to use my kids' term, bummed out when a case doesn't turn out the way it's supposed to.
Maggie, I don't know if there's another specialty like oncology in terms of, you know, the challenge that you all face. Any comments about this?
Well, I think, you know, you have to understand what the end result is going to be when you see the patient for the first time. I mean, the first time you see that patient in your family, if they have metastatic disease, it's a process, and you know what the end point of the process is. And so your job is to guide them through their process. And that can oftentimes be very difficult because there are people who are unique and wonderful and have great families, but that's where it's going. For me, it's vitally important that I just have time away from oncology, you know, at night, on the weekends. I have a long drive home, and to me, it's my time to put everything in the box. Everything goes in the box. The box lid goes down so that when I get home, the box is closed, so that I don't torture my family or myself anymore about what's gone on at the office. And I think, you know, you have to have that way of putting it in the compartment and letting it go. Because we all see patients like this that for the life of you, you cannot figure out why they didn't do well and just don't, or recur when they shouldn't have recurred. And they're nice people. And I think that is hard. And just, I think having time away, I sort of do this little quarterly vacation thing. Because you have to have that time where you can just absolutely let it all go and come back so you feel refreshed so that you can do the things you need to do for your patients with the right amount of intensity and care so that you don't get burned out. And that doesn't come across as, because you have to come across as caring, and most oncologists are, but you have to be able to have the energy to do that too.
Curious about your thoughts, Corey. At one of these sessions, Hi-Mus, we were talking in breast cancer, said he thinks there's some kind of selection process, and the people, maybe like me, I mean, I end up in an education who really don't have the ability to deal with these kinds of things, you know, just get out of the field. What do you see when you look out in oncologists, particularly pulmonary oncologists, burnout? How do you see people coping?
I think there's a certain degree of altruism in this profession. None of us in this room lacks that. You couldn't do it if you didn't have that impulse. In Judaism, there's a concept called tikkun olam, It means mending the world. And I think that is sort of a governing instinct for a lot of us who go in this profession. And then Eric used the word failure. It's the failure of the disease. It's the failure of the agents. It's not your own personal failure, but it's hard not to internalize it that way. So as Maggie's pointed out, our best defense mechanism is compartmentalization. If we didn't do that, we wouldn't function. We wouldn't be able to negotiate our family lives or private lives, and frankly, I don't think we'd be as good oncologists for our other remaining patients. So necessarily, we've got to do it. You've got to refresh yourself. You've got to sort of have some other extracurricular interest that distracts you at least for a while from your main profession. And managing expectations is a tough issue. It's tough in the easiest families who have a fairly sophisticated understanding of the disease process. It's tougher yet in families that have alternative health beliefs, in unsophisticated families who really don't understand what's going on, in families that have inherent skepticism about medicine in general. So even in the best of situations, and I've learned through processes similar to yours, that I always tell them there's a chance this is not going to work. You've got to be prepared for that. So hope for the best, but anticipate the worst.
Curious too, and I'll ask Greg, you know, is this a topic, you know, that we should be pursuing in CME? This little conversation we've had the last 10 minutes, is it something that, you know, people just coming into the field, fellows, should be exposed to more? Greg, any thoughts?
No, I think it's absolutely key for people to learn about it, hear about the perspective of experienced colleagues. It makes a huge difference. And I think we don't talk about it a lot in training right now. It's really becoming more of an area of research interest for a lot of people to try to understand burnout and that sort of thing. Oftentimes that gets buried in data then, which makes it hard to identify with. And I think that, as with so much in life, mentors make a big difference. And this field is no different. You need a mentor who you can talk with about this difficult patient, this difficult family, and not about, you know, whether to pick first line TKI, but how you deal with various situations, both on a patient-to-doctor relationship, but also how you deal with them emotionally. I think it makes a big difference. And I think a lot of times we're lucky to have partners in our groups that we can talk with, but a lot of times we don't. And in that situation, it's all the more important to have, you know, colleagues that we know nationally or something like that that can serve as sounding boards for the difficulties of this job.
So, Greg, let's talk a little bit about new agents and pathways that are close to reaching practice, beginning with anti-PD-1.
I think that hands down, the thing that most people are excited about, I think, is anti-PD-1 strategies, immune therapies in lung cancer. We've pushed back on immune therapies because we haven't had any good results for decades. There's always one patient with kidney cancer who responds to something every year, but there's never been anything exciting for non-small cell lung cancer with immune therapies. That's really changed with some not exciting data with ipilimumab. It's really not particularly exciting, but it's potentially of interest and it's being studied in a randomized fashion. But this anti-PD-1 drug, which targets specific immune pathways, has shown significant single-agent activity in patients with non-small cell lung cancer in phase 1, suggesting that this is really a potential pathway. How it moves forward is really a big question. Is this something that we're going to be given with chemo up front, or is this something that we're going to be giving as a single agent at different points? That'll really have to be borne out by clinical trial data, but I think I'm pretty excited about it.
So I think the IPI data, I'm not sure I would use the word unexciting, certainly not earth-shattering, but particularly in the, granted it was a randomized phase 2, but the phased in approach where it's given during the third and subsequent cycles of PAC-CARBO looked sufficiently promising at least to justify a clinical trial. And the best data were actually seen in the squamous cell group. I'm sure Tom may have talked about this earlier, but that's been the justification for a big phase 3. Now, maybe it's inadequate, but we don't have that many options for squamous cell patients. So we're certainly, in our institution, thinking of joining that trial. We haven't made a final decision yet, but the trial is just starting. MET is interesting, ARQ-197, which now has a name. You always think a drug might have promise when it converts from a license plate to an actual name. Tivatinib has been looked at in combination with erlotinib, really in the BR21 setting, so in the unselected, non-mutated population. And again, the non-squamous group has shown some PFS advantage, a hint perhaps of a survival advantage, at least sufficient justification to go ahead with the phase 3, which is accruing ahead of schedule. So certainly there's a need out there. It's called the Marquee trial, and it's looking at erlotinib plus or minus tivatinib in advanced non-squamous, and tissues being collected for EGFR status and also for KRAS. 15 patients, so you take it for what it's worth, but again, some hint that the KRAS mutants, who you would tend to shy away from using erlotinib, may have had a preferential benefit. We'll see if that is ever borne out, because we've known about KRAS for 25 years and it's not yet an actionable mutation.
Okay, Luis, can you present your patient?
Okay, I have a 41 Chinese. This one is Chinese lady, female. She had surgery in other institution, and she came to me to transfer her care because she was not very happy there. She was classified as a stage 3 because the surgery showed mesenteric involvement. And that was very weird because the lady was already on adjuvant radiation and chemo. So I asked her why, and she said because the surgeon told her that he has not taken all the lymph nodes. There was one node that the surgeon believed that was compromised, and he didn't take it. So I called the surgeon, and the surgeon told me that he was pretty much sure that there was cancer there and he couldn't approach or he couldn't take it. And so that was the reason why the lady was, I guess, changing institutions. But the other thing that bothered the family is she was a 41 Chinese. And the family heard the news about EGFR, and her family member was in chemo radiation. No? So,
just to clarify, this is a squamous or adeno?
This was a squamous. So the first thing I'm sorry.
Smoker or never smoker?
It's a non-smoker, squamous Chinese. So the first thing I did is, after I talked to the surgeon, I guess there was a justification for the adjuvant treatment. And anyway, she was on adjuvant treatment, so there was nothing to do about that. But the surgeon was right, she had residual disease. She was not tested, basically, because she was squamous. But because she was non-smoker, she was Chinese, and she was 41, I sent the tumor for testing, and it takes a couple of weeks. But the first day I saw her, I also was checking the records, and there was no MRI or CAT scan of the brain. So I ordered one, and unfortunately, in the CAT scan, I found one lesion. The next day, I did an MRI, and I found two lesions. So, you know, I was going to wait a couple of weeks for a test that was going to be done from tumor from another institution, so who knows if it takes more than 2 or 3 weeks. So I took a chance, and we did a stereotactic radiation to these two lesions while we were waiting for the results. And the results came. We had some trouble to get the tumor, so it took like 3 or 4 weeks to get the results, and she had an AML4K mutation. He was EGFR negative. So now she's done with the chemo radiation. She's done with the stereotactic to the brain. We did a PET scan. She's clean. So I guess the question is that we are going to put her on crizotinib, and there is nothing to measure now, or you prefer to put her on observation. Certainly bothersome to me the fact that they thought she has residual disease that probably is being taken care of by the chemo radiation. But she has AML4AK, so maybe there is a role to use the crizotinib now because she's really metastatic. She's not adjuvant.
So she, that's why she never really had measurable disease after surgery,
well,
though, right?
Well, it sounds like she had something visible at surgery that they didn't remove. So if they had imaged it, maybe it would have been measurable. But this was not appreciated at all pre-op.
No.
Did you get the pathology to review?
Yeah, the pathology didn't mention the... No, remember, he said that, the surgeon said that he left one lymph node.
No, I'm just saying the histology. The histology, was it really squamous?
Oh, yeah, it was squamous.
Yeah, it happens. It's rare.
Actually, I even sent to these molecular diagnostic companies, I sent one of them that has a microRNA to do a probe. It's not standard of care, of course, to say if it's squamous or adeno. There is a paper in JCO. So they said it's squamous, so it was really squamous. Because we do some research in lung cancer, I test everybody, but a lot of people in the community believes that it's not worth it to test the squamous. I guess in this case was compelling that she was a young Chinese lady that made me test the squamous. No?
So what do you do? I'm a strong advocate of only testing adenocarcinomas, but I think that this is one of the cases that proves that we can't be hard and fast in our rules. Over the last couple of years, I've become an advocate of testing never smoker squamous, or you know, maybe even patients with minimal smoking history, something like that. Because as doctors, we sit down with the data, and sometimes one piece of data doesn't fit, and you have to put it all together and think about the patient as a whole. And I think that this is a great example where, you know, one piece of data doesn't fit, the squamous histology doesn't fit, and we can't be too rigid in all of our rules. So I completely support the idea of testing people like this.
And what would you do at this point?
So first of all, what was the dose of radiation, do we know? Was it a curative intent dose?
Yes.
Okay. So to my mind, this patient has had complete treatment. She's had the brain metastasis treated. She's had the chest treated. And I would wait to see some evidence of progressive disease before I began crizotinib. The median progression-free survival for crizotinib in patients with advanced lung cancer is something like 9 to 10 months. So the clock's going to start at some point, and you want to wait until you have a reason to treat, in my mind, before you actually do start treatment.
I guess something to follow.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you're being very empiric. I'm really torn, as you are, I can tell. This is actually a fairly common scenario, not so much the disease left behind, but regionally advanced tumor with oligomets, which is what you're describing. It was 2 isolated brain lesions, no other sites of disease that we're aware of.
No.
The chest has been managed as if it were a de novo locally advanced with concurrent chemoradiation, or at least a combination chemoradiation. I'm firmly straddling the fence. She's young. She's at high risk for recurrence. We have no data on the benefits of, quote, adjuvant, or in this case, pseudo-adjuvant crizotinib, so we're really venturing into the unknown. Intellectually, I agree with Greg. I think emotionally, I'm leaning toward treating. At the end of the day, I'd probably wait, but that conversation could go either way.
The other thing that pushes me away from treating this patient is because my biggest concern for progression of disease in her is the brain. You know, she's had one spot treated, and it's quite possible that there are additional lesions in the brain. And crizotinib, as good as it is, doesn't work very well in the brain. You know, the concentrations that we see in the brain are extraordinarily small, and we oftentimes see progressive disease in the brain despite control of disease in the chest.
So in contrast to EGFR TKIs.
Exactly, yeah.
The phase 2 expanded access trial actually allowed you, ultimately it was amended, to allow brain treatment and continue the crizotinib if that were the only site of progression, if patients were continuing to have a clinical benefit response. So I agree with Greg, if the brain progresses, I wouldn't necessarily assume that's evidence that the crizotinib wasn't working. The trouble is you have no easy way of gauging whether it is working. You have nothing to follow. So again, intellectually, I think you'd argue not to do it and to wait.
What about the overall paradigm, Greg, of treating ALK-positive tumors? Do we need to wait for the IPASS-like trials comparing crizotinib to chemo, or right now, if you start with crizotinib?
I definitely start with crizotinib if I know a patient has an ALK rearrangement up front. The FDA label is only for, you know, ALK-positive lung cancer. It doesn't specify line of therapy, which I have to say is a moment of rejoicing that we've stopped thinking about lines of therapy and we think about lung cancer in a more sophisticated way. So I use it up front if I have to, if I have a patient with an ALK-positive lung cancer. And I think that the data is going to bear that out, but certainly we'll see the data in the next couple of years.
I was surprised, but actually quite grateful when the approval came out independent of line of treatment. I certainly thought it would be confined to, quote, salvage or second line and beyond. And the data will come out, but I think it's going to be immaterial to our practice. It's really supportive for the continued indication.
Corey, can you talk a little bit about your experience with the drug in terms of side effects and toxicity?
So the side effects, I think, are generally more manageable than erlotinib. The rash is minimal. GI side effects are not terribly severe, certainly far less than you see with chemotherapy. There's some diarrhea, but not much. The LFT elevations are mostly paper toxicity. The original trial called for dose reductions. And intriguingly, if you did that and they were doing well, you could, in some cases, you were able to actually re-escalate the dose back to the target dose without necessarily seeing further LFT elevation. So there's sort of this tachyphylaxis that's occurring. The light-dark accommodation issues are transient. Some of my patients, we have about 25, 30 people on it right now. Some haven't even had it, but they're all, talk about managed expectations. They know they've been warned about it. It's in the consent.
What do you tell people to expect?
Not to drive for about an hour after taking the drug, to expect trouble accommodating light and dark, going from one environment to another. Some of the patients do get these flashing scintillations. It's sort of weird, but it goes away. It's never, at least I've never seen it to
be permanent.
Is
that acutely when they take it?
It's as soon as it's absorbed, so within a half hour to an hour of taking it.
I would say the most common symptom that my patients report is like strings of light or dark strings in the periphery of their vision, and it happens, I can't tell you how many times I've heard this description, when they turn the light on in the bathroom in the morning, that's when they see this. It lasts for 10 seconds, it's gone. You know, the amount of time that oncologists and people involved in the development of crizotinib have spent talking about the light-dark abnormalities, the visual problems, is far more than any patient has spent on it.
Absolutely agree.
The patients don't mind it at all. It's a transient thing. It's helpful for them to have been warned about it ahead of time so that they know what to expect. But in general, it doesn't bother patients.
What I have seen, and this is not really reflected in the, frankly, in the package insert, because I don't think it's necessarily kept up with long-term usage, a lot of these patients are developing peripheral edema, which you can see with other drugs. And I've seen a depression of albumin in a fair number. I haven't actually tested them for nephrotic syndrome or proteinuria, but I wonder if things of that sort might be going on. Again, it's fully manageable. And I've seen extremely good results in some patients. I wonder if they may have been false positive ALK. Their disease blew through it.
What about pneumonitis? Wasn't that also?
My partner, Tracy Evans, has seen that. I have not. Have you seen it?
I've seen a few cases in which the specter of pneumonitis was raised. Some of those patients turn out to have progressive cancer with lymphogenic spread. And that's a common problem we have in lung cancer, is trying to separate pneumonitis from progressive disease. And that's certainly been the case for us. But the lower extremity edema, or the edema problem, is really one that is not captured as well because it's something that happens after patients have been on it a long time.
And the light issue, that's a retinal toxicity or something?
We don't know. That's the truth.
What would the thinking be about why it happened? Because there's a higher level at half an hour if you take the drug?
I don't know.
I'm curious it doesn't work for brain mets, but somehow messes up your vision.
Right.
Scary what I don't know. I never even heard of that. It's unbelievable. I mean,
but it's very transient, and the patients are well warned. I've never had a patient go off it for that. I haven't had any patients go off for toxicity.
And it's interesting, actually. Some patients don't read the consent or don't hear about this ahead of time, and you ask them how they're doing, and they say, I'm doing great. And you know, I've had a handful of patients who've seen the nurse practitioner with me, and the nurse practitioner will say, oh, they didn't mention anything about eye stuff. And then I go in, and I know that this is an issue, and you ask them. And I would say that it's probably underreported, the eye stuff, because patients don't mind it at all. It's just, it's not an issue for them.
So they get up in the morning, they turn on the light in the bathroom, and then what do they see, or what happens?
They see some strings in the peripheral vision. And it goes away in 10 seconds or
less. Have you heard of this in other drugs, or this kind of a side effect? Mm-hmm.
There are some other, I think some of the MEK inhibitors might also be doing this.
So there's specific eye toxicities with MEK inhibitors as well. I think it's a different process because with the MEK inhibitors, you can actually see the ophthalmologist can see changes in the retina.
And eye problems are probably more common than we really acknowledged. I mean, remember, erlotinib can cause conjunctivitis. I have a lot of patients complain about dry eyes or irritated eyes, even some that have had symptoms that sound like conjunctival abrasions. And PEM over time can cause periorbital edema. Docetaxel and PEM can both cause epiphora, hyperlacrimation. So it's out there, particularly patients who are otherwise doing well. You don't tend to see these problems right off the bat.
PEM can cause epiphora. Have you ever had to stent somebody because of PEM?
Once.
Wow.
Taxol does as well.
Taxanes and PEM.
If you give a fair amount of these drugs, as we do, we spend a lot of time talking to patients about this side effect. It's kind of an amazing thing.